I'm John Batchelor with David Petrucia. His book is 1920, The Year of the Six Presidents. Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Warren G. Harding, Franklin Roosevelt, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover are the six presidents. One man who will not become a president. He is, however, a candidate again on the Socialist Party ticket. He's a state senator from Indiana. His name is Eugene Debs. He wins less than a million votes in the 1920 election. This is the year after strikes across the country, frightening the nation, frightening both parties. It becomes a quest to destroy the radicals associated with the Bolsheviks of Russia. America's reading the headlines from Europe, that is Europe that is torn apart in Bolshevik revolution or socialist revolution or communist revolution. Germany is torn apart and creates the conditions that we know will be the tragedies of the 1930s. Where is Eugene Debs running for president, David?
He's in the pen. He's in Atlanta Penitentiary. And the reason is because he had spoken out against the war. The motto of the Socialist Party in during World War One was anti-war. He had spoken out against the draft, and I think they got him on the Sedition Act, prosecuted him. Wilson was, as I said earlier, not used to brooking opposition, and he was determined that as long as he was president, Eugene V. Debs, even though the war was over, was never going to be granted clemency or be let out of jail. He's pretty popular. Debs is pretty popular with his fellow prisoners. He's able to issue statements from his jail cell. The newsreel cameras even come in, and the photographers come in for his announcement. Candidates used to get notified after the convention, like big surprise. Hey, guess what? We nominated you, Calvin Coolidge, for vice president. And then they would go to Northampton, Massachusetts, and give them the news, so to speak. So they have an actual ceremony for Eugene V. Debs. They were thinking about, the Socialist Party was thinking of nominating a woman as his running mate, which would have been historic, but it also would have been more historic because she was in jail too. And they thought they should have somebody on the ticket who can actually get around.
The Republican sweep is no drama here. It's not close. It's never close. Wilson has damaged the reputation of his party with his insistence on having everything exactly as he said it the first time. Wilson's personality, whatever it was before the strokes, has no flexibility. And Cox and Roosevelt are aware that they're behind the whole time, but they campaign relentlessly. Warren Harding even attracts Hollywood. I love the Al Jolson scene, David.
Yes. One of Harding's supporters, a guy active on the Republican National Committee, is a guy named Albert Lasker, a Chicago advertising exec. And he brings in, for this front porch campaign, it wasn't a hit or miss. They brought in literally hundreds of thousands of people onto Harding's front lawn. And they might have the Black Methodists come in the morning and the Black Baptists come in the afternoon, and certain tradesmen, certain occupations, certain ethnic groups. And they actually have the show business people come in one. Well, Lasker had been a shareholder in the Chicago Cubs. So they try to bring the Chicago Cubs and other baseball teams in to perform for Warren Harding. And they bring Al Jolson in, who composes a song about how wonderful the Harding campaign is.
I can't remember. Was Babe Ruth there? Did Babe Ruth show?
No, hell no. Because he was a Democrat. And not only was he a Democrat, but I think at this point he's already playing for the New York Yankees, who are owned by Jake Rupert, the big brewery man, and a former New York Democratic congressman. So if he knows what's good for him, he keeps his mouth shut.
They take the front lawn of Harding's house and they turn it into asphalt, because otherwise it would have turned into a muddy pool with so many people traveling in. However, the election goes heavily for Harding and the Republicans, note how people learned about the election, because they didn't have any easy communication system. It was the early moments of radio.
Yeah, it's a radio with an asterisk. It's like they're broadcasting the results from the roof of a department store in Pittsburgh, which reaches how many people? Hardly anybody. But what they do is people go out of their houses, and they might shine the results on the walls, exterior walls of newspaper offices. Or you might go to a theater and they would interrupt the movie and tell you what state was doing which and what, however. So you got the news almost instantaneously, but not in any way, shape, or form as we would recognize it today, or even 4 years from that.
The results are overwhelming. 16 million votes for Warren G. Harding, 9 million votes for James Cox of Ohio, which is a 60% to 34%. I don't know if it's ever been, maybe somebody's done better than that, but in any event, it's overwhelming at the time. 404 electoral votes for Harding. Harding has a reputation today, I believe incorrect, of being a poor administrator and a man who only did what he was told by his bosses. Doherty, for example, he has people who celebrate, who advance him out of Ohio. And you have an opinion, David, that he was a very good administrator. He made some good decisions, hard decisions, and he was agreeable to the American people. Is that correct?
It certainly was a very good politician. He's mourned, widely mourned, deeply mourned, when he dies in 1923. There's a passage in the book where Doherty is giving him some advice during the campaign, and Harding, in writing, just lays him out on the floor and says, you think I don't know what I'm doing? I know what I'm doing up and down. So don't try to tell me what to do. He could be very strong when he wanted to be. And he's very strong in terms of restructuring government and getting government back in shape in terms of less spending and getting debt down, things which were considered important back then and may yet be considered important again.
He is a man also with a weakness, a weak heart. How long did he know that, David?
I think he knew it for quite a while. If you take a look at of him full face, front on, a portrait, and he's a good-looking guy, right? Everyone agrees on that. You get a picture, full standing, of him in profile, and he looks like William Howard Taft. He's got a hell of a gut on him, and this had to be quite the burden on his heart. People are not sure what he has. They think he has a stroke in 1923, but it is a heart attack. The idea of a heart attack is still not quite known to the medical profession and the government at that point.
You've mentioned how Cal Coolidge, who was on vacation at the time in Plymouth Notch, one phone, and they need to send to the house to tell them that he's now president. He's staying upstairs in his childhood room, I imagine. His father's there. I think it's the father who answers. Who answers the door? Cal or
probably,
John?
Probably the father, because Cal comes down. They give him the news, and there was only one phone in town. It was in the general store. The general store was not open 24/7, so they couldn't reach him. And the reporters and Secret Service guys had to come from about 10 miles away up the road. They do that, and they swear Cal in, or his father swears him in, because he was a notary public. They determined that might do the job then. And his words are supposedly on getting the news, "Well, I think I can swing it."
And Cal Coolidge heads back to the White House, and I know his reputation is extremely positive for his time in office, not all about how he chose not to run again. He loses a child in office, and what I read of Calvin Coolidge over the years is that public service was everything for him, and the sacrifices he made as president were part of his. He believed that he had to make those sacrifices in order to do the best job he could, which is what his father taught him to do. Work as hard as you can.
as interesting as it is and informative as it is to visit Plymouth Notch, visiting his home in Northampton, Massachusetts, which he held on to and went back to after the White House, is really informative because it's half of a two-family house. And I got in to visit it. It's not a historic site, and there's a mailman living in it now. I mean, that's how modest it is. The front lawn is about the size of my office. And he said, I lived this way so I could be independent and do the job I was elected to do.
The book is 1920, the year of the six presidents. David Petrucci is the author. Two to go, Hoover and Roosevelt, who are star-crossed, we know, in the tragedy of the Great Depression when we come back.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.